Rob, come and join me. You're going to be answering our question today, Jesus and Muhammad, what's the difference, does it matter? And I'm going to hand over to you in just a moment. Now, you spend your time working for a church. Just tell us how it was you became a Christian.
I was brought up in a Christian family. I was dragged along to church. Didn't really rebel against it because it just seemed too difficult to rebel. I was kind of quite obedient, but not necessarily believing. But then when I was about 16 or 17, someone took me through a Bible passage at the end of Luke's Gospel, where Jesus rises from the dead. And in some sense, God opened my eyes. I couldn't think of another plausible explanation as to why there was an empty tomb other than Jesus rose from the dead. So I think that kind of set me on a path of really believing who Jesus is, what he said, what he did, and it should be followed.
I mentioned just now you work for a church. You're spending your time particularly trying to engage with people who believe Islam, Muslim believers today, and try to explain the Christian faith. Just tell us some of the steps before you got there.
Thank you. Well, I think when coming to understand more of who Jesus is and realise he's not just for people like me, but for everybody, he offers forgiveness, peace with God, paradise for all kinds of people forever, whatever background, whatever religious background. So that kind of started things off. We, as a family, my wife and three children, we live in Tower Hamlets in East London. And there, most of our neighbours are Bangladeshi, Muslim neighbours. And Jesus' forgiveness and offer of peace with God and paradise is for them as much as it's for me and anybody else. And so we wanted to share the truth about Jesus. He'd risen, he'd bring forgiveness to them, too many of them. Sometimes they, for first generation Bangladeshi people, their English isn't quite as good as mine. And so we decided to go to Bangladesh to try and learn as much of their local dialect, Sylheti, so that we could speak to them about Jesus in their language. So hopefully they could realise that Jesus wasn't just for English speakers, but for all languages and peoples.
And so you do actually speak Sylheti?
A little bit.
I think you should prove that to us. Go on, give us a sentence.
Isa al-Masihi. Amrare kub maya choroin.
Which means?
Jesus the Messiah very much loves us.
And on that note, straight over to you.
Thank you. The rest will be in English, I hope. You've got everything you need to follow along with where we're going in the next 20 minutes or so on this little booklet sheet. A couple of cheesy pictures, posters copied from the internet for you. Keep calm and love Muhammad, S-A-W. S-A-W is the Arabic phrase for peace and blessings be upon him. The Christians, not to be outdone, say keep calm and love Jesus more. What I don't want this session to be is a kind of playground, I love Jesus more than you love Muhammad. My God's better than your God type thing. I hope it won't become like that and won't be going on in our minds. But I just put that out there because that's what I don't want this to become. Now, I don't know why you've come here and what you're hoping to get out of it, but some people, when they think about Muhammad and Jesus, he's just the same. The Islamic greeting, Assalamu alaikum, means peace be with you. Jesus says that on that first resurrection Sunday to his disciples, peace be with you. So maybe these guys, they're just the same. There is no difference. They bring peace. Some would say, that's nonsense. They may say peace, they may proclaim peace, but actually, there's violence underneath. Just look at what's done in both of their names. David Suchet has done a documentary recently on the three Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Islam, Christianity, and has said they each seem to proclaim faith, salam, peace, shalom. But why is there so much violence? Yeah, so maybe Muhammad and Jesus, they're the same in violence. Or maybe you're thinking, these guys are pointless, irrelevant to today's world. Muhammad died 1,400 years ago. Jesus was around 2,000 years ago. How is that of any importance to whatever stage of Brexit we're in at the moment? To austerity, to global warming, to really important things in our country, in our world? There are some similarities between Jesus and Muhammad. Both claim to be prophets. Both talk about God. Both talk about sin, judgment, paradise, those kinds of things. But there are also lots of differences between them. And often when you dig down to the meanings behind these similar words, there are lots of differences. One Jewish rabbi has said that it's in differences that we find wisdom. It's in contrasts that there's true understanding. A very silly illustration of that. Tomatoes are classed as fruits. They're the same as bananas. But we don't put tomatoes generally in a fruit salad. The difference between a tomato and a banana is really important when it comes to fruit salad. I would argue the differences between Muhammad and Jesus are even more important than a fruit salad. And understanding these differences is relevant now and forever, as we'll see. I'm not going to ask you to shout out or to talk to your neighbour in an uncomfortable way about these things. But as I waffle for a little bit now, what do you think? Before coming to this talk, what do you think about Jesus and Muhammad? And then as we get to the end of the talk, think about whether you've changed your mind in any way. So we're going to begin with Muhammad. What do you think about Muhammad? Clearly, I'm a Christian. Clearly, in some sense, I'm biased. I'm not following Muhammad, I'm following Jesus. But as with any historian, or you hope journalist, or anybody else, we'd hope we could be objective about evidence. And I put down here evidence from Islamic sources about Muhammad. The only non-Islamic source that I put down here is a very positive one towards Muhammad. But it also means you can go away and check these things out further if you want to find out more. So first point really is that Muhammad is just a man. And this comes from a modern Muslim website. According to Islamic belief, the Prophet Muhammad was the last messenger of God. He, like all of God's prophets and messengers, such as Noah, Abraham, Moses, and Jesus, was only a human being. Christians came to the mistaken assumption that Muslims worship Muhammad by formulating an incorrect analogy. They worship Jesus, so they assumed Muslims worship Muhammad. This is one of the reasons they called Muslims by the incorrect name Muhammadans for so many years. Muhammad, like Jesus, never claimed divine status. There was a book by an eminent professor of Islamic studies at Oxford in the 1960s called Muhammadanism. And this website was saying, no, that's just wrong. It's incorrect analogy. That's not just a modern website. Muhammad's closest companions recorded on that bottom bullet point on the first page, a guy called Umar, who became the second leader of the Muslim community after Muhammad. And he is said to have said, I heard the Prophet saying, do not exaggerate in praising me as the Christians praise the Son of Mary, for I am only a slave. So call me the slave of Allah and his apostle. And this comes from the hadith. The best collection is by a guy called Bukhari. This is a summary of Bukhari. It normally comes to about 9 volumes this long. And there's a summary here, which you're very welcome to look at if you'd like to afterwards. But yeah, one of Muhammad's closest friends says, he's just a man. Over the page there, another of Muhammad's closest friends. This is the first leader of the Muslim community after Muhammad. When Muhammad died, a guy called Abu Bakr, he said this, whoever amongst you worship Muhammad, Muhammad is dead. But whoever worshipped Allah, Allah is alive and will never die. Allah said, Muhammad is no more than a messenger. Many were the messengers that passed away before him. Abu Bakr there is quoting the Quran at the end. Muhammad is no more than a messenger. Worship God, not him. So we've had this modern website, we've had a couple of friends of Muhammad recording the hadith, the sayings and doings of Muhammad, and now the Quran itself, the next bullet point says this. Muhammad is to say, I am only a human being like you, being inspired that your God is one God. Whoever hopes to meet his Lord, let him work righteousness and never associate anyone with the service of his Lord. Muhammad is only a human like you and me. But the difference between him and us is he's received inspiration, revelation. The Quran is what makes him, sets him apart. And part of what the Quran says is work righteousness. That's how you get to heaven. You do good. And make sure you never associate anyone with God. None of this Trinity nonsense, you Christians. So Muhammad is just a man and shouldn't be worshipped. And yet, when I talk with my Muslim friends, often it feels like they do worship him. They put him on a pedestal. Even if they don't formally bow down, it feels like functionally he is their reason for being. And here are some quotes, I think, that lead to that conclusion. Again, from the hadith, none will have faith until he loves Muhammad more than his family and all humanity. Muhammad is to be the person in your heart, more than your parents, more than your children, more than your spouse. If you obey Muhammad, then you're obeying Allah. If you disobey him, then you're disobeying Allah. You can't get a cigarette paper between Muhammad and Allah. They are one, in a way. I think that comes across in the confession of faith that you say to become a Muslim. There is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet, that they're together. And he's the best example for people to follow. The Quran says this. And then here's a non-Muslim quote. Philosopher, orator, apostle, legislator, warrior, conqueror of ideas, restorer of rational dogmas, of a cult without images, the founder of 20 terrestrial empires and one spiritual empire. That is Muhammad. As regards all standards by which human greatness may be measured, we may ask, is there any greater man than he? I was doing a meeting with a Muslim society and a Christian society at Guy's Hospital 2 weeks ago. And it was about why I follow Jesus, and the imam was speaking about why he follows Muhammad. And why he follows Muhammad was all about these kinds of things. He is the most wonderful, perfect human being you could ever wish to follow. He was deep in his heart. I think most of my Muslim friends, in some sense, have put him on a pedestal, even though he's supposed to be just a man. But if he's on a pedestal, you can understand then why many Muslim people find it offensive if he's mocked in cartoons or otherwise. But I think there's a real problem with putting him on a pedestal and following him that way. He's unsure that he's hearing God when he first receives what he thinks might be revelations from God. This history book, The Life of Muhammad, is the earliest history of Muhammad's life, translated into English in the 20th century, but based on documents from around the 9th century, 8th century and 9th century. And it says he's unsure about hearing from God. The Quran is clear that Muhammad doesn't know where he is going, or where his friends might be going if they follow him. You can't clearly offer them paradise. The Quran is clear, too, that Muhammad does no miracles, apart from the Quran, which is said to be his miracle. And on top of the next page, the Quran is clear that Muhammad sinned, and he asked for forgiveness. He's no different from any other human being in that way. And then more soberly, he approved of mockers being killed. There was one lady who was a poet, and she spoke poetry against him, mocking him. And he said, "Who will rid me of this meddlesome woman?" And somebody did. He was involved then in many different battles, some of them defensive, but not all of them by any stretch. In one particular battle around Medina, he had a Jewish tribe that was working, fighting with him. They then changed sides. Muhammad and the Muslim armies won. And those 500 to 700 Jewish people, recorded here, Jewish men, were then beheaded and their bodies were thrown in a trench. Now, when I've talked about these kinds of things in the past, some people said that's just not true. So I was doing this talk a couple of weeks ago, and another hospital, Bart's Christian Union, asked me to put it on. And some Muslim students came up to me after and said, "That's just not true." And so we looked at these references together. They were new to these people. A week or so ago, though, I was doing that kind of discussion on the Isle of Dogs in a small mosque there. And our Muslim friends there, they knew these references. And they said, "Well, those Jewish tribes, they were traitors. They deserved to die. And that woman, that poetess, she mocked. She was leading people away from Muhammad, and so she deserved to die." My question to them is, if you're following Muhammad's example, when do you know which part of it to follow? Much of what ISIS does, or did, for example, is following Muhammad's example as recorded in the history here. Now, that's not saying that all of our Muslim friends must follow ISIS, but what ISIS does seems to be justified from Muhammad's example a whole lot of the time. I'm doing a master's in history at the moment at Queen Mary University. I'm looking at really gentle subjects like the Crusades, like jihad, those kinds of things. Just completed an essay on Osama bin Laden and his understanding of jihad. It's clear that there's lots of issues going on in his life as to why he wanted to fight. There's Western hypocrisy, there's colonialism, there's injustice. But there's also the Quran and Muhammad's example. It's very clear when you look at what he says about what he is doing. And my tutors seem to agree with that. Now, again, this is not to say that all of our Muslim friends are going to do this or want to follow it in this kind of way. And this is not to say either that anything like happened in New Zealand is in any way justifiable. One of my friends in Tower Hamlets, her cousin was killed in one of the mosques in New Zealand. After the incident there, I went with a number of other Christians to East London Mosque to show solidarity with Muslim people there. That is wrong, it is evil. But There's still the example of people like ISIS and the Charlie Hebdo killers that seems to be following what's recorded in these histories. So, what do you think about Muhammad? What do you think about Jesus? The early part of Luke's Gospel, there are copies over there, talks about Jesus being born of a virgin, proclaimed by angels. He resisted temptation. He proclaimed good news. He brought forgiveness. He was authenticated by miracles. All of those things are agreed with by my Muslim friends. Chapter 9 of Luke is where we might part company. Those first 8 chapters of Luke are all about those kind of things. In chapter 9 of Luke, it really comes to the conclusion as to who Jesus is. He does all these miracles. He gives other people power to do miracles. Who is he? King Herod and the crowds think maybe he's John the Baptist come back from the dead or another prophet. Well, Jesus then asks his disciples who they think he is. And the first bullet point there is Jesus is the Messiah or Christ. They both mean the same thing, meaning anointed one. Now, it happens that as Jesus was praying alone, the disciples were with him. And he asked them, who do the crowd say that I am? And they answered, John the Baptist. But others say Elijah, and others that one of the prophets of old has risen. Then he said to them, but who do you say that I am? And Peter answered, the Christ of God. Peter there is picking up words promised from hundreds of years before he was speaking, that one would come who would be anointed by God, a Christ, a Messiah, a long-promised king. That king was promised in 2 Samuel 7 to David. That king was sung about in Psalm 2 as the one in whom you must take refuge to be safe. That king was promised in those great Christmas readings like Isaiah 9, for unto us a child is born. So this long-promised king is what Peter's talking about. But he's not just that. Jesus is the Son of Man who dies and rises again. And Jesus strictly charged and commanded them to tell this to no one, saying, the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. When Jesus takes the title the Son of Man, he's claiming to be this global ruler, a long-promised global ruler that the prophet Daniel talked about. Again, hundreds of years before, Daniel has a vision that a Son of Man will come and be given all authority over all people for all time. Jesus is saying, that's me. Daniel also has a promise, along with Isaiah, that this global ruler will be cut off for sins that aren't his own, that he will die in the place of others, so that he can bring them forgiveness and rescue from God's judgment. And so Jesus is the long-promised global ruler and rescuer that God has promised for many years before. And then finally, on the last side of your sheets there, Jesus is God's Son and Chosen One. Now, about 8 days after these sayings, he took with him Peter and John and James and went up on a mountain to pray. As he was praying, the appearance of his face was altered, and his clothing became dazzling white. And behold, 2 men were talking with him, Moses and Elijah, both of whom had been up mountains in their past. Moses at Mount Sinai to receive the 10 commandments, Elijah at Mount Carmel to battle with false prophets there. So Moses and Elijah, who appeared in glory and spoke of his departure. The New Testament, this bit of Luke's Gospel, wasn't written in English, it was written in Greek. And the Greek word for departure is Exodus, the word for the second book of the Bible, which is all about God's rescue of his people, his liberation of them. So Jesus is going to do a rescue mission, an exodus, which he's about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Now Peter and those who were with him were heavy with sleep, but when they became fully awake, they saw his glory and the 2 men who stood with him. And as the men were parting from him, Peter said to Jesus, Master, it's good we're here. Let us make 3 tents, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah, not knowing what he said. As he was saying these things, a cloud came and overshadowed them, and they were afraid as they entered the cloud, and a voice came out of the cloud saying, This is my Son, my chosen one, listen to him. And when the voice had spoken, Jesus was found alone, and they kept silent and told no one in those days anything of what they'd seen. Jesus left on the mountain alone. Moses and Elijah have faded into the background. Moses, who brought the law from Mount Sinai. Elijah, who enforced the law at Mount Carmel. Jesus is left, not Moses and Elijah. In some ways, Muhammad brought a law and tried to enforce a law. Well, Jesus is greater than anyone that brings or enforces a law, this is telling us. not least because he's God's son. This is my son, the voice from the cloud says. The cloud that appeared at Mount Sinai, the cloud that appeared in the Jerusalem temple. This is my son. And because Jesus is God's son, he can reveal God more fully to us than any prophet could do. He knows God intimately. He knows God fully. He can say exactly what God is like. And he knows where he's going. He's going on this exodus, this departure, this rescue mission. He knew what would happen to him then and beyond, and could offer paradise to those who followed him, certainly. And he is the chosen one and should be listened to. Nobody else. And so it's beholden on all of us. Will we listen to him? And finally, Jesus is relevant now and forever. He said to all, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross daily and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will save it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him will the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels." Jesus says that if we are to follow him, we should deny ourselves. We should put other people's interest first, not our own. I think that's of supreme relevance for today. Think of how Brexit discussions might have been different if people had put their own interests to one side and worked for the interests of others. Think what our communities might be like if we didn't serve ourselves but others. Think what our families would be like. That's why what Jesus says is relevant now. But it's also relevant forever. If we are ashamed of Jesus and his words now, when he returns, he will be ashamed of us. And he's returning as this mighty Son of Man with all power and all authority over all people. So in some sense, we should be thinking about what we think about Muhammad and what we think about Jesus. These are important things. But in many ways, the even more important question is, what would Jesus think of us when he returns? And whether we've been ashamed of him and his words. Back to Chris.
Wait a second, Rob. Don't go anywhere. We have a few minutes left, an opportunity for questions. I've got a question I want to ask. If there are any questions on the floor, we're very happy to take a few questions. We're meant to end at 25:25, which means we do have time. I did ask Rob to try and finish a little bit earlier today so we could do that. Rob, thank you for everything you just said. Very helpful in all sorts of ways. Just explain in terms of some of these differences. I mean, you referred to Muhammad as a prophet many times. Is Muhammad a prophet?
I do not think he is a prophet in the way that my Muslim friends would say so. I'm happy to call him that in a sense to give him honour, because my friends want to honour him. But no, I don't think he's a prophet in a biblical sense for a couple of reasons.
But how can you claim that? Because if many people are saying he had a revelation that he is a prophet, how can you say he isn't?
I think primarily because Jesus, particularly so at the end of Luke's gospel here, he says, I have fulfilled the prophets, the law of Moses, the Psalms of David, the other writings, all of those were pointing to me. I have fulfilled them. My death and resurrection is a fulfillment of those things. You need forgiveness. I'm fulfilling those things. It's all pointing towards him. And if Jesus has fulfilled those things, then we don't need to look for anybody else to be a prophet or otherwise. So I think what Jesus says there means that we don't need to look for anybody else, whether it's Muhammad, whether it's you or me, whether it's anybody else that might claim to bring a revelation. We have everything we need there. I think there are similarities between the Quran and the Bible too, but the Quran doesn't teach what the previous prophets said. It's not in keeping with what was revealed before through Moses and David. And again, that's why I don't think it's a true revelation from God in that way. But it takes you back to Jesus and what he said and did. And if it is in fulfillment, then I need nothing more, which means that we should be looking at what Jesus said and did.
That's very helpful. Does anyone want to follow up any of that? If not, I'm going to ask you about Christian violence. Question over here. Sorry, yes. Would you just like that clarified? Could you just want to say a word on that, Rob?
Yeah, so I'm sorry, I don't consider him to be a prophet in the biblical sense and following in Jesus' footsteps, all the examples of the previous prophets, like Moses or Isaiah or David. It's kind of talking about a Muhammad in a kind of an honorific way, because that's how my Muslim friends would. Mm. But maybe it'd be more accurate to say their prophet, or the prophet of Islam, or the prophet they follow. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry if that wasn't clear.
That's really helpful. Look, we've still got a few minutes. I think this might take a couple of minutes to answer, so let me just dive in. I'm sure many people here have heard it said. I've often heard it said, as a Christian leader, that one of the accusations is, well, many things that were done in history in the name of Jesus, in the name of the Christian faith, seem very violent. Some of them are in the Bible, and some of them, you mentioned the Crusades that you're working on at the moment. How do you explain that? Because that starts to make Christianity look quite similar to Islam.
I think in some ways that's very true. So there are lots of Christian scholars, particularly of the Crusades, that would say in many ways the Crusaders were copying what the early Muslim armies had done when they came out of Arabia and into Syria and across North Africa. And they were fighting for God to get paradise. It's a complete misreading of what the Bible teaches. If only they'd known and believed that it's through Jesus' death and resurrection that you get forgiveness. That fighting wouldn't have happened. But yeah, there's fighting in the Bible. And I guess the hardest case is, say, the case of Joshua.
Just before that, just let me clarify. So on the Crusades, what are you saying about the Crusades?
I am saying that they thought, I think most of the common people, apart from the leaders, thought that they would get paradise if they got to Jerusalem and fought people. That is not true. That is not what the Bible teaches. That is not what Jesus says. When his disciples say, here are a couple of swords, he says, put them away. When they try and fight for him, when he's arrested in Easter week, he says, stop it. And he heals the man. Swords are not for now for his followers in any way at all.
Okay, that's really helpful. Sorry, I interrupted. You were going to say something about the Old Testament.
People might say, well, yeah, okay, we can get possibly kind of explain away the Crusades. What about Joshua? The book of Joshua, when the people of God go into the land of Canaan, clearly there's lots of killing. Either that's bad on itself, or that's the example you should be following, and that's bad too. So how do we explain that? I think it's still very hard. I'm not disputing that, and I'll come back to that in a minute. It's not an example for us to follow for a few reasons. Firstly, God had promised this judgment to come 400 years before. He said to the prophet Abraham in Genesis 15 that you're going to be out of this land and I'm going to give the people there 400 years in which to turn away from their sins, their wickedness, their evilness, their child sacrifices. But if they don't, my people will come back in and exercise a judgment on these people and take the land. So in some sense, rightly or wrongly, it was a God-ordained judgment. It was also only for that time and only in that place. They weren't to extend the boundaries of the land. They weren't to go elsewhere. They weren't to do it for personal rewards and gain. So it's mandated by God for a specific time, for a specific purpose, and is not for us to follow. But what was happening there, in some sense, is a precursor of what will happen in the future. And this is the really sobering thing. We're to read that and see that the enemies of God, those who continue to turn away from him, will be judged. That's sobering. So when Jesus returns as the mighty Son of Man, one of the pictures in the book of Revelation about him, right at the end of the Bible, is as a mighty warrior like Joshua, who will judge his enemies, those who are against him. So it's not for us to do. It's still hard, but it is what will happen, which again makes me think I should turn back to Jesus, and makes me want to tell others about him so that we might be safe on that day of judgment and seek refuge on his side rather than be against him.
Rob, thank you. We are now out of time, so thank you very much. Do grab a seat.